Okay, so we have a bunch of stuff on the agenda tonight, so I will kick it over right now to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And we have quite a few slides, so I'll get right to it. And first of all, I want to do a follow-up on Python programming using ChatGPT. And if you're at the monthly meeting last week, you saw Tom trying to cajole ChatGPT to write a Python program for him. And he did write some Python program. It did a really good job on writing a little graphic utility for him. But then he got off into the weeds in the main event. And that was kind of interesting because what happens is that there's multiple ways to do things when you program. There's always several ways to actually write the program. And I think what happened was Tom asked ChatGPT a question which he'd asked before to test it out. So he asked the question live, but he got a different answer. And in particular, it was an answer that required a programming module that he didn't have installed. And then that was down the rabbit hole. So what I'd like to do is just take another look at basically the same process, but a slightly simpler version of it. But before we do that, we're going to take some advice from a couple of members. So first up, Jocelyn, actually in the chat last week, said this: learning to ask questions to ChatGPT is a skill in itself, and we're all struggling to find out how to do it. And that's very true. So asking the question or asking lots of questions is one of the trials and tribulations of using ChatGPT successfully. And then our ChatGPT guru, Bob Harris, said, or actually he's going to say, this is from an upcoming presentation, which Bob is going to give us later this year. And I highly recommend it. It's a really good presentation. But it's using an AI engine. And one of his comments is, it's usually good to add lots of context and be as descriptive as possible. So when you're asking your questions, you really need to give it lots of information. So let's take a look at just one file that Tom was trying to play with. And I highly commend him for doing this. If you looked at the transcript of a Zoom session, you'll find that it's actually quite difficult to read. And the problem is they break up individual comments into multiple segments. So you can see here that I've extracted just a piece of the discussion from last week where Chris is introducing Tom. And you can see it starts off, I'd like to introduce our speaker who, and then there's a new segment starts, needs no introduction because. And so what Tom was trying to do was combine all these things so that it made kind of sense that you had one bunch of text per speaker, essentially. So if you look at this file, this is basically a straight text file. We can ignore the numbers and we can ignore the spaces. And the things that are of interest are these individual records, which have a couple of lines or several lines, but basically the first line has a timestamp. And you can see that's basically hours, minutes, and seconds, and whatever. So the timestamp is in those bunch of numbers there. And then the next line has the name of the participant, the person who's actually talking. Remember, this is a speech-to-text transcription. So this is who's talking, and then this is what the individual says in that segment. And on that particular line, you'll notice that the name of the person and the text is separated by a colon. So we can use that to our advantage. And so I've actually done quite a bit of programming with various things, not so much Python, but quite a lot of programming. So I think, how would I go about writing this program? So I'm going to tell ChatGPT, look, what I want you to do is do this and do this and do this. So here's my thing for ChatGPT. Write a Python program to open the file called transcript.txt. Locate the line which has got all those weird numbers. I'm not interested in all the numbers. I just want the first eight, the hours, minutes, and seconds, and the colons. And if you look at that, it's basically eight characters. There's six numbers and two colons. So I'm telling Python, I'm telling ChatGPT, save the first eight characters on this line, once you've found it, as a variable, and call that variable timestamp. And then go to the next line and think about the colon. Save all of the characters before the colon as another variable, which we're going to call name, the name of the person. And on the same line, save all of the characters following the colon and the subsequent space, right? So colon space, and then the text starts, up to the occurrence of a blank line. Because remember, it could be one line, two lines, it might be five lines before the segment ends, but it always ends with a blank line. And we're going to save that, the text, essentially, as a variable called text string. And then what I want Python to do, or ChatGPT, I say, write the variables timestamp, name, and text string on a single in the file output.txt. And you notice that I screwed up there, and it wasn't deliberate. I was supposed to say on a single line in the text file, and I inadvertently missed that. And then once you've done that, we've dealt with one record, right? We've saved the timestamp, we've saved the person's name, we've saved the text. Repeat this sequence until the end of the transcript file. So that's what I'm telling ChatGPT to do. You write me a program to do all those things. And sure enough, it says, here's a Python program that accomplishes the task that you described. Now, we're not going to look at the code. We're not even going to consider what the code does. We're just going to look at the output. So here's the input file. Yeah, my mouse would behave. Here's my input file. This is the output file, right? So what I've done is I've taken that code, I just copy the code, save it to a Python file, a .py file, and then run that Python file script under Python. And I get this output. And you notice that it's sorted out the timestamp, just the eight characters. It's got the name and it's got the text, but it's creating individual records on multiple lines. When I thought I told it to write on one line, but of course it didn't. I omitted lines. So maybe it didn't quite understand that. So now we can go back to Python. Remember, we're not looking at the Python code. We're going to let ChatGPT worry about writing Python for us. So I'm saying, all right, don't write the variables on the individual lines. Write them on the same line in the output file for any given timestamp. So sure, I'll do that, yada, yada, yada. Give me some more code. And I run the new code, and now I get this. So now it's actually done what I wanted in the first instance. I've got the timestamp, I've got the name, and I've got the text on individual lines. Well, now what I'd like to do is do the second part of the problem. Combine all the text for Chris Taylor, which are the first, three records there. And then when we get to the last five records, combine all the text for Tom Trottier. So I'm going to tell ChatGPT, all right, if the name variable for the next record hasn't changed, right? So if the second record is the same as the first, the same person is speaking, ignore the timestamp and name variables and concatenate the text string with the previous value of text string. So the second record gets added onto the end of the first, separated by a space, because remember we threw the space away, colon space, and keep doing that. And when the name changes, then start a new output line. And ChatGPT says, well, if you want to do that, then we have to use a variable to keep track of the previous name. Okay, that's fine. Go do it. And here's the output we get from the final Python code. Now you can see it's doing exactly what I want. each record has kind of been concatenated. So I've got a timestamp, I've got a name, I've got all the text that belongs to that person, and then I go to a new timestamp, a new name, and all the text that belongs to that new person. And it basically works as advertised. Right, so now here's the code. So you don't know Python, I don't know Python very well. So let's, rather than go through this stuff, let's just ask ChatGPT. Explain to me how the code works, ChatGPT. Certainly, let's go through it step by step. And it begins by opening the input file, which we told it was transcript.txt, in read mode, and it reads all the lines into a list called lines. And then it iterates over each line using a for loop. So for the first line, do this. For the second line, do that. For the third line, do that again. And then for each line, it strips white space. It finds this character, this dash dash angle bracket, which tells it which line is the timestamp line, and it does various things. So here's the actual code or a snippet of it. And if we look at a couple of things here, all right, here's where it starts off. It says with open input file R, so open the input file as read only, and then read all the lines into this array called lines, right? So for the input file, read lines and store it as the array lines. So it's the Python code is doing exactly what ChatGPT just told us. And then here's the for loop. So for every line in the lines array, strip out the white space. And then if you see this character string, then save the first 8 characters on that line, right? The number of characters on line from the beginning to character 8, so the first 8 characters, save that as timestamp. So I didn't actually look at any code there. If you think about what I did, I had ChatGPT basically do everything. I just looked at the output and I kept telling ChatGPT, no, you haven't done that right. Do something else until eventually it works. So actually, it does a really good job. Sometimes it takes a little while, but it can be a very useful tool. Now, one of the reasons I'm looking at this tonight is because then we have a question came in, and the question was, I want to import Excel data into a fillable PDF form. And in particular, this individual, Bob White, is trying to import data from Excel, from a spreadsheet, into one of the Canada Revenue Agency's tax forms, T5013. Well, I actually don't know how to do that. So Bob Harris would tell me, well, ask ChatGPT how to do it. Well, sure, why not? How can I transfer data from Excel to a fillable PDF automatically? And ChatGPT says, well, do a whole bunch of things. And the whole bunch of things says, organize your data in Excel so that each column corresponds to a field in the PDF form. Now, one of the things about this is you don't have to believe everything that ChatGPT tells you. Personally, I wouldn't set up my spreadsheet so the data was in each column. I'd much prefer to have the data in each row of a given column, and you'll see why in a second. And then the next thing it says is, you're going to need a scripting language, something like Python. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, this is a really great question because here's the OPCUG treasurer, poor guy. It's income tax time. And even though we're a not-for-profit corporation, we don't pay tax, we have to fill out a whole bunch of forms for our corporate tax return. And here's one of the forms, and you notice that it has a field here for the corporation's name, what's the business number, it wants year, date, month, whatever, and then there's a whole bunch of numbers it wants in here for various things. Some of them I don't have to do anything with, but some I do. So every year, I have to fill out a bunch of these forms, and the corporation's name is always the same, and the business number is always the same. And so wouldn't it be nice if I could do this using a Python program? So supposing I set up my spreadsheet with a descriptor in column A, the corporation's name, and the actual data which belongs in that field, the Ottawa PC Users Group, in column C, in cell C1 in particular. So let me go and tell ChatGPT, write a program to copy the contents of cell C1 from this file called taxinfo.ods, which is a LibreOffice calc spreadsheet, to the corporation's name field in a PDF file called T2 short, which is a corporate short form return. So that's basically what I'm going to do. I'm only in one field because clearly I need to see if this thing is going to work before I do lots of things. So here I gave it the instructions, and it says, okay, to do that, you can use Python. You might need this library called PyExcel and something called PyPDF2 and a whole bunch of things. And I'm actually using Linux, so it's telling me, you can install them via pip if you haven't already done it by giving this pip install command and installing these various modules. So I just run that in a terminal window in Linux, and that installs those modules. And then here again is the Python program. Again, I'm not going to look at the code. I don't really care at this point what it's doing. I'm just going to go down here, just copy the code, paste it into the Python script file, run it, and the first thing that happens is I get tons of error messages. This is the error message from that program. And you can look through this stuff. But down here is basically the problem. There's an error with PyPDF2 module. It's a deprecation error. You can't use this PDF file reader module because it's deprecated and it's been removed, and you need to use this instead. Now, I'm not going to look at the code. What I'm going to do is I'm going to copy that error message and paste it right into ChatGPT and say, here's the problem, basically fix it. So it says, the error message says that the thing is deprecated and you've got to do this. Let me update the script accordingly. So again, let me just copy the code, run it again. And it turns out you have to run it again and again and again because it came up with 13 different errors and missteps. And some of these errors it fixed out. And then I got the problem where it thought it did it, but it turned out all of the fields in the output file were blank. And then the next time it did it, it wrote the corporate name onto page 1, which is actually a page of instructions. There's no output field there. So I had to tell it, look, the fillable field starts on page 2. So do something different. And it still didn't work, hasn't changed. But eventually, having fed all this information back, it produced an output file that had the corporation name written into the correct field. So I said, that works, thank you, and I'm welcome. And now OPCUG has a happy treasurer, because although there's lots of work to do to try and make that thing work for all of the fields I need, clearly I can do it, and in particular ChatGPT can do it, so I can tell it how to do things, and hopefully I can automate my tax filling program, not process. I can get it done automatically.
And it will only take you about 100 years worth of time that it would take filling it out manually.
Yeah, but I've been doing this for 15 years, filling out those damn forms anyway. All right, that's it for me. So somebody says it's a funny piece start, and the reason this is from Bing Image Generator. I told it to give me an image of a happy treasurer in Victorian England. So that's actually Big Ben. Okay, next up we have Chris with a share.
Yeah, so Harvey posted this in the OPCG member forum, and I thought it was interesting and maybe of use to other people. So Harvey has some clients, and they had some Dell users that were complaining about sluggish computer performance. And these are the sort of things that, yeah, you hear once, and you sort of dismiss a year twice, and you sort of think, I wonder if this is a pattern. You hear it a half a dozen times, and all of a sudden you think, maybe there's something about Dell computers right now. So he checked on one of the computers in the reliability monitor, which is a really useful tool to tell you when crashes happen within Windows. So he saw several cases where it was Windows installer reconfigured the product. And in most cases, there were well over 100 instances recorded, and entries were continuing to repeat. And so it all pointed to Support Assistant apps. So he uninstalled all Support Assistant apps, and restarting the computer resolved the actual problem. So if you want to try to play around a little bit in Support Assistance, the easiest way to get to it, the Reliability Monitor, the easiest way to get to it is you press Windows plus R, which opens up the Run dialog box. Type in perfmon space slash REL, and click the OK button, and it'll come up with a timeline. It'll show you warnings and errors that are occurring when different programs have problems, either an update fails or a program crashes or whatever, and then you can delve into it a little bit more to try and figure out what's going on your computer. So I thought it was an interesting thing in and of itself, but also as a general tool for troubleshooting, running Reliability Monitor is a really nice tool. That's it for that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So next up, we have an item which is everything old is new again. This is from Jeff Dubois, and he's reminding everybody that in the good old days when we all used DOS and modems, we had to dial telephone numbers, and some of us did it using software. And he said he used a program called EasyDial. And if you remember, there was a Hayes modems had an AT command set, which turned out to be fairly universal. And so, when you had to dial an outside line from an office, let's say, you often had to dial 9, and then you had to wait for the dial tone to appear. So when you were doing this automatic dialing, what you would do is you'd put a 9 with a comma in front of it, and that would basically pause the dialing or the auto dialing for a second or two to give the dial tone time to engage. So in using EasyDial, you would basically create a phone directory, have the person's name, and then put in a 9 comma comma, so that's a double pause, if you like, then the person's name, then another pause, and then the extension number, and EasyDial would actually dial things up. And it would basically send this command string down the pipe, and the telephone system would react accordingly. Now, interestingly, Jeff points out that this same method will work on cell phones. Now, of course, with a cell phone, he says you don't have to use a 9 for an outside line anymore. But if you have to call an extension, what you can do in the cell phone is put the phone number, a comma, and then the extension number, and the phone will do the auto-dialing for you, which is a really neat trick. So if you have any kind of applications like that, Jeff has a neat way to do things. Okay, moving along.
Wait, one moment. This also doesn't just work for extensions, but it also works for like menu trees inside of a phone system, like one for internet support and so on like that. So if you know the sequence of numbers, you can put that in your phone directory in your phone and use that rather than having to wait and wade through the menus.
Yeah, very good point, Tom. The phone doesn't care what the comma's for. It just puts a pause in between the next time it sends a number. Okay, we had a question came in. I think Chris has the and supporters.
Yeah, so this came in from Doug Johnson, and he said he was trying to copy cells from a Google Sheets spreadsheet into a Google Docs document. And he Googled for help on how to do it, and it was, came up and told him that, you go into Google Sheets, you load the file that you're trying to deal with, press Control-A twice to select the entire file, do edit copy, and then go to Google Docs, start a new file, and do an edit paste. And he found that in all cases, the screen just froze when he did that. So I did some testing, and I think the Control-A twice seemed to be the issue. And the problem is that in all likelihood, it's not something you actually want to do. You don't want to copy the entire spreadsheet, which a Google Sheets spreadsheet can actually be up to 10 million cells, and you wouldn't really actually want to paste in 10 million cells, most of which are going to be blank, into a document. So it could be that it would actually work if you wait long enough. I certainly didn't have the patience to actually try to see if tomorrow it would actually have pasted in 10 million cells. So what is probably wanted is just the cells containing data. So it turns out if you select the cells containing the data that you want to paste into your docs document and copy it from Sheets, paste it into Docs, and it actually does work. Next. So then came in a clarification. So he didn't like the fact that formatting in Sheets, things like center alignment and so forth, was lost when it was pasted into the Google Docs document. He could adjust them later on, but he would like to have things like if there are phone numbers there to automatically insert the dashes and various things like that. And that feature didn't seem to be available in the docs table that actually got created when you did paste. And he also liked the option in spreadsheets where you can lock the top line and the left line, and then when you're scrolling around, you'll always have your left column and your top line. And so that sort of feature is not available to you either. Next. So what he then said is that he's trying to get a spreadsheet that will be able to be updated by various users by sharing it. And can I use Sheets as a shared file instead? So the whole point was not that he was really trying to get this into a Docs, Google Docs document. What he just wanted to be able to do was share the data that was in the Sheets spreadsheet rather than actually copying files, copying data into a document file. Next. So that's actually pretty easy. So to share a Google Sheets file, so you would go to browse to drive.google.com. If you're not logged in, log in, and that'll bring up your personal drive, and then find your file that you want to actually share. Next. Then you click the kebab menu, the three vertical dots. Next. And then in the menu that pops up, you select share, and then in the flyout menu, you select share. Next. And then you'll get a dialog box where you actually can put in who you want to share this with. Now, you could just share it globally, that anybody with the link to the file would be able to go in and potentially edit the file or at least see it, depending on the rights that you assign. But you probably want to restrict access to a file like this. So in the share, you know, whatever your file name is. In my case, it was a file I just called source sheets file. And so in the share and the document name box, you enter the Google account for the people you want to edit, be able to edit the file. Now, if a person has got a Gmail account, it is automatically a Google account. And if they don't have a Gmail account, then they want to use another email address like a Simpatico or Rogers email address, you can make that into a Google account, and I've covered that before at Q&A. Next. And then once you type in the person's email address, you'll get a drop down which shows their name. And if in this case here it's a fake address, so what it's really showing is display name and the email address, but because this is a fake thing, there's no display name, so it's just showing the same thing in both cases. So you just click on the results box that pops up down below it. Next. And then you'll get the option to set their role. And so you can set it as either, it's a read-only, or you can set it as editor. And in this case, he wanted other people to be able to edit this file directly. So you can set their role to editor, and then anybody that you add in this way will be able to edit the file. The cool thing about it in Google Sheets is that they can all edit the file simultaneously. And so if you're editing the file and someone else is also editing the file, each of you will actually see cell highlighting where the other person is currently at, so you can avoid modifying the same cell at the same time. And they're color-coded, so you will actually see different people's that are editing the file at the same time. You'll see where their cursor is at any point in time. And as I say, you can just avoid modifying that cell. They may be actually editing that cell at that particular time. So that's how you can go about doing it. So I think that this is a more elegant solution than trying to copy the data into a document file, and everybody would have access then to be able to edit the file directly. So that's it.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. So next up we have a Looney Link, and the Looney Link is from Bob Harris, and he's going to tell us all about it.
Okay, thank you, Alan. This is about Donovan Burry. He's been doing this for quite some time, but during the past 6 months, he's been interviewed by almost every local radio and TV station. So as it mentions here, this fellow gets up really early before dawn every Wednesday morning. And he begins scouring all the new grocery prices with every flyer he can get his hands on. He goes to the websites of the stores, and one of the tools that he uses is Flip. And what he's going to do is, come to the end of this, he's going to post these things. We're going to come around here again. He posts the highlights of these deals on Reddit. And his name is Crimson Tape. That's his, I don't know what they call that anyway. That's his stage name. But his real name is Donovan Burry. So let's have a little look at what one of his favorite tools is, Flip. I like Flip also. And Flip is it's both a website and a phone app. And I use the website and the phone app. All you have to do is enter your postal code, and it'll show you all the grocery stores in your area. Now, it does other stores, Home Depot and hardware stores, but tonight we're on groceries. So it'll show you the grocery stores in your area. And if you want to get a free account, you can clip items, make your own little shopping list yourself. And going one step further, you can get yourself a little free account. You can sign in with your desktop PC and make yourself a little list of what you want to pick up, and then go to the grocery store and have the very same list on your cell phone. You sign into your cell phone. It's very handy. So anyway, you can go through all this, and you'll find all the best deals on Flip. But getting back, with all the marketing, it's quite easy to miss out the best deals. They have, there's five of them for this price, and there's three for that price, and then 10 in the big box. Which is the best deal? It's not always simple. They do try to confuse you, and it works on me. So going back on to Donovan here, he gets up early in the morning and logs all these prices into a massive Excel spreadsheet. And he posts them on Reddit so everybody can see these things. Now, when you arrive here on Wednesday morning at the above link, you'll see the little headline, this week's rookie review, and the dates. Now, sometimes, and more recently, he's been adding more content to his stuff. So you might have to see that item. If he posts that in the morning, usually around 9 a.m., he might post other data on top of that. So you'll scroll down and find where the meat and potatoes are, which is his grocery list. And it's a big list. And so take the next page here, please. And here's an example of his list. You scroll down, it's many, many pages. This list, Adonis, I don't even know what that store is, but he goes through all the Ottawa area grocery stores. He does Food Basics, FreshCo, Independent, Loblaws, Metro, Superstore, Sobeys, Walmart, and more. But it's not just the prices. It's the comments that he adds to the, he might just say it's a fair price. Or you might say on there, nice, that's a great price for maple syrup. You might say, see, wow, that's an amazing price. Or something else, it'll say, I don't know, it'll say beets, holy cow, stock up. Or you might say, that's a fair price for tomatoes, if they're nice. At the end of each section, he also posts some of his comments. He'll give some of his opinions on the produce of that store, whether it's a Food Basics is better than Farm Boy. He has an opinion on that. Anyway, this is a great site to go to Wednesday morning around 9 a.m. And it's invaluable if you live in the Ottawa area. But lastly, you don't just have to use this for your shopping. You can use these prices for price matching also. You don't need to go to all these stores. I mean, No Frills, Giant Tiger, Superstore does price matching. So you can say that I can find it somewhere else at, I don't know, at Food Basics or Freshco. Anyway, it's worth checking out. At 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, all the best prices are there, and the comments are the best things, and it's free. Hope you all enjoy it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. And there's one comment, a different flyers online option from Tom, I think it is. Flyerca.com is another thing which sounds a bit like Flip.
Yeah, I think Donovan uses a multitude of other sites, and probably that one too. Yes, there's so many. Some of them give you the advance flyers too, I believe, also before Wednesday.
Okay, thanks very much. On to the next. Chris has a share on ad blocking.
Yeah, so this is something that Tom just posted today on the member forum. So a bit of a promo for the member forum. If you're not a member, you might want to sign up. There's lots of activity on there about interesting things. This one here, I came, I saw this, and I thought, this seems pretty cool, and I wanted to test it out. So it's a cool site. It has a huge number of ads and trackers that are built into the web page when you go there. And let me just paste this. And then it will let you know which ones were actually blocked in your browser. So you can, if you've got an ad blocker or tracker blocker installed in your browser, it can tell you how effective it actually is. Next. So what gets tested? And so there's all kinds of things. So there's ad scripts loading, whatever that is. Next. And then there's actually ads. Next. And then you have analytics. So a lot of places like Google and that will do analytics on showing where you go and things like that. There's error trackers, whatever that means. Next. There's social trackers. So Facebook loves to follow you everywhere you go on the web and things like that. Next. And you have Mix, whatever that is. Next. And then others or something like that. Anyhow, there's a ton of things that it actually checks to see whether things are blocked or not. Next.
There's OEMs. That must be.
Oh, sorry, OEMs.
Manufacturers.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a number of different ones like Dell and things like that that may be trying to track you and things like that as well. So they have those. So on my Google Chrome, I actually have three extensions installed that could be doing blocking of ads and trackers. So I have Avast Online Security and Privacy, and I have Malwarebytes Browser Control, and then I have uBlock Origin. And I know for sure uBlock Origin should be blocking a lot of the ads and trackers. I didn't know whether the other ones were actually doing blocking of ads and trackers or not. Next. Now, before you go on. That's fine. Go on to that one. This was an interesting thing. I don't understand their arithmetic. When they say there was a total of 140, which is a previous slide, was 140 different things, and 138 were blocked and zero were not blocked. So what about those other two? I don't know what it means. But anyway, I wasn't too worried about it. Next. So then what I did was I decided to disable the extensions and enable them one by one. And so with just Avast Online Security and Privacy, it's clearly not doing much in the way of blocking. So there were four block and 136, so things actually added up in this case to the 140. So it could be still doing other useful things for me, so I'm not about to just ditch it because I think that there are other functions of that particular plugin that are probably doing some good things for me. But clearly, it's not blocking ads and trackers. Next. When I enable just Malwarebytes Browser Control, it actually does a pretty good job. So in this case here, again, we're getting into math problems, but 135 were blocked, and then three were not blocked. So it was doing a pretty good job of blocking ads and trackers. Next. And when I enabled just uBlock Origin, it blocked all 140 of them. So it's actually excellent at blocking ads and trackers. So again, Malwarebytes Browser Control, it probably is doing some other things, and so I'll leave it there. Clearly uBlock Origin is doing the best job in terms of actually blocking ads, trackers, and things like that. Next. So even though I don't understand their arithmetic, I do find that it's an interesting site, and it can be very useful to test whether whatever ad blocker you are using, whether it's doing a good job or not. And if you're not using an ad blocker or tracker blocker, it certainly seems like uBlock Origin is one of the best that is out there. And so I could highly recommend that you install that. That's all I have for that. So thanks, Tom, for that.
Very good, Chris. Thanks very much. And so we have managed to get through 54 slides in 43 or so minutes, which is quite amazing. But that means that we're into the last 10. Actually, we're into the last 16, I guess. So if anybody has any questions, comments on what we've been talking about, or items that you'd like to share, now is the time. Put them in the chat, or feel free to unmute your microphone, talk to us, wave your hand, whatever.
I'd just like to comment that uBlock Origin also has a lot of other things that are useful. For example, if there you always get a pop-up for subscribing to a particular website or something, you can right-click on that and choose Block with uBlock Origin, and then it will allow you to choose the level in the web page of what you want to block, and it highlights that level in red so that you know, because there's like the individual sentence, and then there's a box around it, and then there's the bigger box and so on. And the biggest box is the whole page. But you can choose what box you want to block, which just has the ad on it. So uBlock Origin is also quite malleable to be able to choose to get rid of stuff, for example, cookie log, that you don't want.
Yeah, very neat.
And Tom is right. The uBlock Origin, I use it with Chrome. Sometimes you go to a website and it's not happy that you have an ad blocker. And you go to the extensions and disable it in literally two or three clicks in Chrome and you're back at business. So I don't know what people use for browsers. I use Chrome, but...
It's easy
to
turn
off. Is that a free HARO software?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it's available in the Chrome Web Store.
Glenn is asking, which ad tracker blocker do you recommend for use with Microsoft Edge?
Well, Edge is based on the Chromium engine, so you can install any of the Chrome extensions into Edge as well. So just go to the Play Store with Microsoft Edge, and then search for any extension you want, including uBlock Origin. And rather than a button saying install in Chrome, it'll say install in Edge. And you click on that, and it'll go ahead and install it.
So it also works with Firefox.
Yeah, that's the one major difference, is that a lot of the extensions, it just depends on whether they've only built them for the Chromium engine-based browsers, or you will often find that they have a separate extension that's available for Firefox, which is based on a different rendering engine. So, yeah, any of the Chromium-based, no problem going to the Play Store. The others, yeah, if you use Firefox, which I guess is the other major one that is not based on Chromium, it's up to the vendor whether they actually created an extension for Firefox as well.
Harvey says that he's using Adblocker Ultimate on all browsers. And it's he tells me that's a free, that's free software.
My understanding with Adblocker is that they unblock certain ads because they're paid for it by the advertisers. I don't know whether you can turn this on or off, but it's something to be considered when you look at it.
And Jeff Dubois has an interesting comment. He says, if you're using voice reading software like NVDA to read your screen, the reader software will not read the pop-up. So you continue reading with voice while the pop-up sits on top. I guess that's fine as long as it's not a pop-up you actually want.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've been using Rakuten lately to try and get some free money back, and they have a big bugaboo with pop-up blockers and things like that. And usually if I want to buy anything and get Rakuten credit, I have to turn off, you know, all of my ad blockers and pop-up blockers and things like that before going to the page. So I guess that goes to what Bob was mentioning as well, that some sites really don't like it if you've got these blockers in place. I had a thing a while back, what was it? It was on YouTube, that YouTube was starting to not show me videos if I had ad blockers in place. And so I had to basically say that the ad blockers should be not in effect on YouTube, which meant that I ended up having to see ads in YouTube videos, which is a bit of a pain.
So talking about pop-ups, I have a question from a friend who's right now in Arizona, and she had one of these pop-ups which is telling her that her computer is infected and call this number right now or else all bad things will happen. And what's the best way to get rid of that? I imagine if you can shut down the tab and clear all the history, the cache and everything else, is that sufficient, or do you have to do anything more than clear everything?
I think in at least some cases, what it will end up coming from is if you've allowed notifications from a particular site. And so that will end up having pop-ups come up like that. So if you are having pop-ups, look to see whether you've added the ability for that web page to notify you, and if so, turn that off, and then that might get rid of the problem. And to do that, let me just see if I can figure out here. If I go in Chrome to settings, yeah, so if you go into the settings in Chrome and in the search box, if you just type in notification, and it'll come down, it'll give you site settings, controls what information sites can use and show, location, camera, pop-ups, and more. And then you would go down through the permissions on that, and you'd be able to see if you've enabled notification on a particular site. And then you can disable that so that they don't have permission to notify you of anything. That's at least one way that they can actually have the pop-up occur. I'm presuming there are other ways that could be done as well.
Tom made a note that there's a browser plugin called Enhancer for YouTube that will block YouTube's ads
oh,
and
cool.
also has some other features.
I'll have to try that out.
Jeff had posted in the chat about a class action lawsuit settlement for Dollarama. So if you bought batteries and lights and light bulbs and stuff like that, you might get a $15 gift card if you jump through all the appropriate hoops. And B wants to know, is there any reason to use the incognito window on a regular basis?
I use it whenever I don't want to be automatically signed in. So there are some sites that I do want to be automatically signed in when I go to it. Like, for example, Pogo.com, I play games. Well, I don't want to have to sign in every time I load that page. So I have it set to automatically log me in. But if I ever wanted to go to that page and not be logged in, I could load up an incognito window, and it will not be logged in. It also turns off some tracker type stuff and caching of web pages and things like that. So if you specifically don't want to have it cache any information locally, you can use incognito mode. Anybody know other reasons why you'd want to use incognito mode?
Spouses, children, they won't be able to see your history.
Is there any reason not to use it?
Yes, because you lose all your history. You don't have any history. You don't have any cookies. You're not connected into the particular web page. You come in kind of as a new user.
Yeah.
It also, by the way, Chrome at least in incognito mode still tells Chrome where you're going and what you're doing. So incognito doesn't apply to Chrome or to Google, I should say.
Yeah, I wrote an article for the newsletter back not too long ago, within the last year, about what incognito mode really means. And so you could check that article out. It's an imperfect solution for a problem, but it does do some things. Just don't think that it is the panacea for all that ails things in a browser. But it does do some things for you.
And they still know your IP address, so.
Yeah, they have to. I mean, it's just, in order for them to get information back to you, a web page that you're actually wanting to read, they have to send it to an IP address. So they obviously know your IP address.
The way around that, of course, is to download the Tor browser, or if you want to be really incognito, is to get the download the Tails. I think it's a Linux-based system, and boot into Tails, and then everything you do on the Tails OS is very incognito. It goes through the Tor. By the way, I don't know if people know about Tor, but Tor stands for the Onion Router, and basically everything you do gets routed through three nodes before it gets on to the other person or the site that you're visiting, and the same thing back, and nobody knows. Everything is encrypted on the way, and it's encrypted on the way back, so you get it. So this is on top of HTTPS, and it will protect you from being recognized. Now, of course, the downside of this is that, of course, NSA and other sneaky people know this, and so they actually run Tor nodes and then keep track. And if they run enough Tor nodes, then maybe they can actually track what you are doing. So if you're a Chinese spy, watch out.
Yeah, the long and short on that is that it can slow down your browsing a lot, because it has to go through a bunch of extra hops through the Tor infrastructure. But yeah, the website that you're visiting, basically all it will see is the exit node from Tor. They will get the information from it for IP address and things like that. But yeah, I think, I don't know. personally, I think he has to be pretty paranoid to go to Tor. Or yeah, he has to be doing something that you really don't want people to know that you're doing. And there are legitimate reasons for doing that, I suppose, for some people. But I think the average person, it's a little bit overkill and definitely will be slower. So.
So Harvey is asking if a VPN masks your IP. And Jeff says it represents you as a different IP address. It doesn't hide you, but rather disguises you as something else.
Yeah, so basically what it is with a VPN is all your traffic, rather than going directly to, you know, Facebook.com or Google.com or your bank or anything like that, it actually goes to the VPN server through an encrypted tunnel. Then it gets decrypted from the VPN encryption and sent on to the destination. So the destination sees the source as being the VPN server, wherever that happens to be in the world. And then the traffic will flow back to the VPN server, which then encrypts it back into your VPN tunnel and sends it directly back to your computer. So it is useful from the point of view of if you want to appear to be coming from a different country, so you want to get, you know, Comedy Central on YouTube and you try to go directly and it says this content is not available in your country. If you go through a VPN that is located in the States, they think that you're in the States and so they will happily serve you the content. So that's the way a VPN actually works on in that regard. But keep in mind, it really isn't a security thing. Other than the idea that if you are in a Wi-Fi hotspot, theoretically, any of the traffic that you are generating back and forth to another server, if it's not encrypted by itself, then that could be sniffed by anybody who is on that same Wi-Fi hotspot. Now, the flip side to that is that in most cases nowadays, things are encrypted anyways, end-to-end. So, like Google, you cannot use a Google property without being in an encrypted session. Whether it's YouTube or Gmail or Google Search, it's if you try to go there with HTTP, it'll automatically flip to HTTPS. And so you have an encrypted session anyways from your computer to the other endpoint. And most services that you're trying to access are going to be the same way. They enforce encryption. Even if you go to the OPCUG website, it'll be an encrypted session. So nobody can, you know, sniff the traffic and see that, oh, you're looking up information in the Q&A section or something like that. So it's only if you're using services that do not encrypt by themselves that a VPN in a Wi-Fi hotspot would buy you anything in terms of security.
Well, so, by the way, now, one of the services that is not encrypted, aside from ordinary FTP, is email. All your email passes through all servers, and everybody can see it, at least all the nodes that it goes through. So one way to encrypt, to have a secret email, is actually to share an email account with someone, and then you can go in and save things in draft, and they can go in and see your drafts, and so you can talk back and forth. And this is what a U.S. Admiral was using when he was talking with his lover and sharing things with her and got convicted for that because he was sharing things he shouldn't have.
So Jeff says that he uses VPNs regularly to circumvent geo-blocking so he can get streaming video and music from other countries, I guess. Bob Harris says, incognito mode on YouTube is great for watching YouTube with a three-year-old. It means that YouTube will not start sending you children's videos tomorrow or in the future.
Yeah, I suppose. And incognito mode could do the same. Yeah, the incognito mode, yeah, that would be that. So you're not logged into YouTube using your normal account, and so yeah, they don't have any way of tying that back to you, I guess.
Yeah, if you don't do that, I have a great, I mean, they feed me great stuff that I really like. It's perpetual, but when I start to deviate with that, then, oh, darn, I didn't want to see that. Gee, you know, anyway.
Okay, I think we are at the witching hour. We just passed 8:30, so unless there's any last-minute things that anybody wants to bring up, I think we can close out the session. Alan, did you have any wrap-up?
Thank you very much.
I think I have two more slides. But...
Okay.
No, there it is. That's the last slide. So just a reminder that next week is another regular Q&A session, so February the 28th. I don't think we have anything pending, so if you have any questions or things that you'd like to share, send it along to the suggestion box address, and we'll start a new deck for next week. So I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. Lots of interesting things, I think, and good discussion. So thanks for everyone for attending and participating.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.